would like to acknowledge my collaborators, my former PhD advisor, Ramesh Narayan, and Jonathan McKinney. I'm going to be talking about jets, which are produced by black holes and magnetic fields. So let's see, what are the jets? Well, I like to start the talk with the motivation slide. And motivation for studying jets is that they're beautiful and challenging. What do we see here? We see that see two active galaxies, or they're called active galactic nuclei, which host supermassive, maybe 1 billion or a few billion solar mass black holes at their centers. And these black holes are accreting, which means that there is mass around the black holes that wants to fall on the black hole, but this mass has some angular momentum. It cannot just radially fall because it's orbiting the black hole, so it forms an accretion disk. And so maybe we have something like this at the center of each of these active galactic nuclei. We have a black hole in the middle, we have an accretion disk, a black hole surrounded by an accretion disk seems to be a very robust combination to produce a jet. And how these jets are produced and how do they accelerate to humongous velocities? Jet velocities can range from half the speed of light. These are so mildly relativistic jets. They can be non-relativistic, or they can be ultra-relativistic. For instance, jets from gamma ray bursts, they can move at Lorentz factors of thousands, which is 0.999999 times the speed of light. It's ridiculously fast. So understanding how these jets accelerate, how do they collimate? Look at these beautifully collimated outflows emanating from the center. These are the jets. How do they collimate? It's a challenge. And see, they can be more collimated, less collimated. They can be lobe-dominated, or they can be jet-dominated. You can see this jet is kind of fallen apart due to the interaction with the ambient medium, presumably. Then it forms these lobes. And the other jet we don't see because it's probably beamed away from us. It's pointing in the other direction, so we don't see much radiation. But we see a similar lobe, so we infer the presence of the jet over there. And this is a very close galaxy to us, M87 galaxy. Actually, this is the largest, one of the two largest black holes in the sky. One is in the middle of our galaxy, and the other one is this one. If we zoom in closer in, we see that on the scale of 1,000 black hole radii, we see the jet is still going there. We soon will probably be able to resolve the base of the jet, and we'll be able to understand, is the jet coming from the black hole, or from the inner parts of the accretion disk, or maybe both, and probably the answer is both. But you can see here with your eye that things are kind of moving out. You can see blobs moving out. And so these jets probably start moving at slow velocities over there and accelerate as you progress further out. This is also what I'm going to cover. How does this jet get its energy from the black hole, from the disk? That's the second part of my talk. So here is a summary of what I'm going to talk about, how jets accelerate, how they collimate, and where do they get their power? From the black hole spin and from the accretion rate, how much mass per unit time falls in the black hole. So here is a magnetized jet 101. This is a really will encapsulate all of the physics that I'm going to talk to you about in a very, very simple model. So what do we have here? We have a vertical field line. By one end, it's attached to a perfectly conducting sphere. By the other end, it's attached to the ceiling. Sphere represents the central compact object. The ceiling represents the ambient medium. And the central sphere is rotating. A black hole or an infrastar at the center spinning at an angular frequency omega. What does it do to poor field line? Well, after n rotations, the field line will develop n loops, one loop per rotation, because the end points are stuck to the sphere and to the ceiling, and the ceiling doesn't rotate. There is toroidal pressure associated with the loops, and the pressure is given by the familiar formula from high school or college, b phi squared over 8 pi. So the ceiling experiences the push. This will be the jet, pushes sideways. So you have to collimate it from the side. This is the job of the accretion flow that will be hugging this jet and not letting it fall apart. And if we wait even longer, there will be more loops produced. And eventually, the pressure will overwhelm the ambient medium, the ceiling will give in, and this magnetic spring will expand under its own pressure and will pick up any mass that's attached to the spring and it will accelerate any mass that's attached to the spring. Note that the toroidal field is much stronger than the vertical field, so a nice way of understanding this process or looking at this process in an equivalent way is to imagine that there are these toroidal loops that are produced by the rotation of the central object from the initially vertical field, and these loops slide down the original field and accelerate under the action of two forces. Well, what are the two forces? First of all, as the loops move away from the central object, they become more dilute. Therefore, their pressure drops. And so there is a pressure gradient between this and that position of the loop. Therefore, this pressure gradient pushes these loops out. But that's the same force as in any other outflow, let's say in a usual jet, right? The outflow expands, the pressure drops, and that's what accelerates the outflow. Here in magnetic fields, they're characterized not just by the scalar pressure, they're also characterized by tensor pressure, which you can think of as a tension of the field loops. So these loops are pushed out by their own pressure gradient, but they also are slowed down by the tension, which tries to keep them smaller. It is under the action of these two forces that the jets accelerate. This is actually, I'm just telling you about the terms and the equations, but this is actually what's going on indeed. I'm not making it up. What I'm going to tell you is, how does the energy get from here to here? And how do these loops accelerate, and how that acceleration relates to how collimated the jet is? So I will start with an example of an extreme jet, of the ultra-relativistic jets in gamma ray bursts. Particularly, I'm going to be talking about so-called long-duration or core collapse gamma ray bursts. And what is this? Well, we have a carton here which shows main ingredients of the gamma ray burst central engine. We have a star whose core collapses into a compact object, a black hole or neutron star that's rapidly spinning due to angular momentum conservation. This compact object powers a pair of pointing flux dominated collimated jets. As these jets make it out of the star, due to some internal instabilities, they first produce gamma rays, a burst of gamma rays. This is why they get their names, gamma ray bursts. This burst of gamma rays is so bright that it outshines the rest of the universe in gamma rays, while this thing lasts for tens to hundreds of seconds. By analyzing the spectrum of the light curve of these gamma rays, we can infer that the velocities with which the outflow moves are such that the Lorentz factor is greater than 100, can be even larger, 1,000. So this is an extremely ultra-relativistic outflow. And we also can infer, but I'm going to talk more about this, is that probably magnetic fields are not very strong in this outflow, namely the magnetic enthalpy divided by the energy rest mass energy density, rho c squared, doesn't exceed unity. I'm going to talk more about this later. But let's move on. Once these outflows go to further larger distances and they start interacting with the ambient medium, due to this interaction, due to the shock that drives in the ambient medium, they also radiate, which is called the afterglow. So at first it was prompt emission, if I didn't mention. The internal instabilities cause gamma ray production. As you go further and slam into the ambient medium, that's called an afterglow. That from analyzing the afterglow light curves, we can infer that the jets are well collimated. The opening angles are less than 5 to 10 degrees, or in radians, it's less than 0.1. But also, independent of the first three facts, we also get that the product of Lorentz factor and opening angle is quite large. It's much larger than 1. It's certainly, in most cases, exceeding 10. What do we do now once we have all these observational facts? We want to test our models of magnetized jet acceleration and see, does it fulfill this, that, and that? Check, 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 or maybe it doesn't work out. It turned out that it has been extremely challenging for numerical models of jets to actually reproduce all the four facts at the same time. In fact, the first three were a piece of cake. You can get a jet that's very collimated, you can get a jet that's really relativistic, you can get a jet that is not very highly magnetized far away, but this fourth one was impossible to achieve. In fact, it was proved by my fellow Russian Komissarov that this is what the product is constrained to be. Namely, for a jet, just like the one I show here, the product of Lorentz factor and opening angle doesn't exceed 2. I can go and give you an explanation later offline because I wouldn't have time otherwise.
Yeah. There's an argument that it's independent simulation that we
yeah. So actually, well, okay. I'll essentially what this says for a jet to continuously collimate, it has to know about the ambient minimum that collimates it. So it has to be in causal contact. And in causal contact, it means that the beaming angle cannot be much smaller than the opening angle. And the beaming angle is 1 over gamma. And so essentially what we say is that theta, the opening angle of the jet, should be not very much larger than 1 over gamma. And that's what it tells you. That's basically what you do. But you can make it more rigorous. You can put it on a more rigorous footing. So
the soft relation is that that's observed, right?
So all of these four, we firmly believe that they are the case. Maybe this is the most uncertain, but this, if we were to get that relation, then it would make a lot easier to explain how gamma rays are produced, because we think that...
I'm just asking what the distinction between two red boxes are. So the first red box is
The first box comes from the...
red box.
This is observed. This is what we think we can do with these magnetized flows of this shape. Now, when I started looking at this, two solutions come to my mind. Well, first of all, maybe observations are wrong. Okay, well, because this comes from pretty complicated modeling of the afterglow emission. You know, you have to put in certain things, certain microphysical assumptions need to be made about what accelerates the electrons that radiate and things like this. Or we can say that, well, maybe the models like this are not what's going on in nature. Maybe it's not magnetic fields or something else accelerates the...
mentioned this cartoon scenario where you had the magnetic fields. I'm wondering if the magnetic fields are present before the collapse of the star or are generated due to collapse. And if it is not the case, don't you expect other kinds of radiation like synchrotron radiation or
So let me rephrase the question. You're asking where the fields are coming from that will get into this jet. And what was the second part?
The second part is if the magnetic fields are already present before the gamma ray occurs. Don't you expect other kind of radiation like synchrotron radiation?
So we think that these magnetic, we don't really fully understand where the magnetic fields come from. That's the short answer to your question. There are problems with assuming that these fields were part of the star because then it would be hard for the central part to collapse and form a rapidly rotating black hole because they will torque the rest of the star and the inner material will transfer all the angular momentum out and then so you will not get a rapidly rotating black hole in the center. Maybe they are produced in situ in the accretion disk due to the turbulence. There will be a dynamo that produces these fields. But with the radiation, there are details that I want to get into. But you want to not only explain the radiation energy, but also the time variability, which happens on the very short time scales, which puts extra constraints. And synchrotron emission could be part of it. The standard model was that forget about magnetic fields. You just have a central engine that spews out for whatever reason. Chunks of material which are very weakly magnetized. These chunks of material come at different random times with different velocities, and so they will catch up somewhere far away, and you can make an estimate of where they will catch up, and you get roughly the right ballpark of the estimate in the right ballpark, and then they shock each other, so-called internal shocks, and these shocks produce the sharp peaks, the spiky light curve that you observe. But this model also has its own problems. So let me not get into that, though. If we move on further, and we recall that for this type of continuously collimated jet, we get this relation. Now, how can we modify the models in the most trivial way in order to try to relax this constraint? And if you look at this, you see, okay, well, the jet is traveling inside the star. It's continuously collimated by the very heavy stellar envelope. But once it gets out, it's vacuum. Come on. Why do I have to continuously collimate? I can just go wherever I want. And this is the element that I included in the model. The jet gets out to the surface of the star, and then it's free to expand. Once you include that, you immediately get this from the model. So all of the tension with observations is gone, and now we're happy. So let me show you how that happens.
But
Yeah, can I ask? So what do you get? You can get that in two ways, right? You can open the theta, keep the gamma constant.
I will. You will see in a second.
All right.
Yeah. So this is what was known already, and I will show you a simulation that reproduces this result, that for a continuously collimated jet, which I will collimate with the wall, it's just for simplicity, so I concentrate on the jet properties, but it could be a Stellar envelope or anything else. The product of Lorentz vector and open angle is 2. Now, I will have another simulation where the wall will confine the jet up to a certain distance, which is the radius of the star, and then the wall will recede, letting the jet expand and do whatever it wants. And we will see that both the open angle and the Lorentz vector increase, and the increase in both of them leads to a product of 20, which is much more comfortable for agreement with observations. Okay, so let's see. So on the left, you see a continuously collimated jet. On the right, you see a deconfined jet. The surface of the star is shown with the green line. The top edge of the box is 5 radii of the star. Notice that the radial scale is stretched. You can actually see the jet. The jet is really tiny and collimated. The stretching is about a factor of 5, just for us to see conveniently the structure of the jet transversely. And the color shows the Lorentz factor, actually the log of the Lorentz factor. The blue color is Lorentz factor of 1. Red color is Lorentz factor of 1,000, 10 to the 3. The white lines show the lines in the plane of the board. So I don't show the toroidal field, which is actually the dominant component. See, most of the jet is of yellow color somewhere at the surface of the star. So people would measure the open angle at the surface of the star, the color, and the color is yellow, so it's about 100. So gamma times theta, 100 times 0.02 is 2. Good. Okay. Disagreement with observations. Problem. Let's then curve the wall, make it open up right where we think the edge of the star is, and bingo. What we have is that the jet now is free to expand sideways. There is more area, therefore the pressure as the jet expands sideways decreases, therefore this pressure gradient pushes the jet out and can accelerate it. Why does the jet not fall apart completely? Because everything is beamed forward. You're going at a Lorentz factor of 100, therefore at most you can change your direction by 1 over gamma, by 1 over 100. So at most you can change your open angle by a factor of 2. You were at an open angle of 0.02, now maybe you can get 0.04, and that's exactly what happens. The open angle becomes from 0.02, it becomes 0.04, and Lorentz factor jumps up by a factor of 5, and the product of these two gives you an increase from 2 to 20. We're done.
Sorry. Yes, I got a question.
Can something wasn't clear.
No. You got an argument based on causality that gamma times theta would be order of 1.
Yes, if the jet is continuously collimated. But once the jet is free to expand, and in fact, show you the end result. So you see, I start curving the wall smoothly outwards. I could do that if my numerical scheme would let me do that, and in fact, I tried. The results are completely insensitive because, see, this black stripe, this is vacuum. The jet doesn't fill in all the room all the way up to the wall. That's because it just can turn faster than the signals can propagate. And after we forget about the wall, the argument doesn't work anymore because it's the wall that had to communicate its presence and announce its presence to this center of the jet saying, look, you cannot open up too much because I'm there. But now that the wall isn't there, this argument doesn't apply. So you can accelerate in principle as fast as you can. And the only reason why we don't go all the way to the maximum Lorentz factor, which you will see in just a second, is because of the hoop stress of magnetic fields, because it says, I don't let you accelerate all the way. There will be some fraction of energy locked up in magnetic fields forever. If that wasn't clear, relax, and I'll show you in just a second.
This we did with an ideal MHD simulation?
This is ideal MHD simulation.
And then when you adjust here, is the pressure or the atmosphere, you just lower it by hand
So here, the only difference between these two simulations is the shape of the collimating wall, which models the ambient medium.
Right.
In real system, we would expect there will be stellar envelope here, which would redirect the jet to small and small opening angles. But in order for me to simplify the problem and highlight the physics of the jet rather than of the star, I just put a wall of a prescribed shape, and I curve this wall outwards just where the star surface would be. Here the wall doesn't curve outwards, it's continuously collimated, whereas here I curve it out. Yep.
What's generating the wall in the face of the vacuum? what produced that wall is the compiler of the magnetic field.
What produced the wall?
Yeah.
In which case?
In the case that you are studying the vacuum.
Oh, in the case out here? Well, there is no wall in the case of vacuum. So I model the absence of the wall by curving the wall by so much that it's no longer causally connected to the jet.
What happens if you don't put a wall at all?
Sorry?
What happens if you don't put a wall?
Exactly the same thing will happen. So if I put the wall until here and then I remove the wall, exactly the same thing will happen. Because removing the wall is equivalent to making the wall causally disconnected from the solution, meaning that no waves from the wall can talk to the jet. And that's exactly what happens. I curve the wall out, and you don't see this this here, but there is a separation between the wall and the jet, the black region. That's where it's no man's land. The wall no longer can talk to the jet. That's it. The wall is not doesn't exist from the point of view of the jet. So it's equivalent. I could have curved the wall like this, like that, or completely remove it. It would give me exactly the same result. So there are two questions, and after these two questions, quick questions, I'll go further.
Why is it only the outside of the beam accelerating?
Well, see, it actually will fill in if I go further, but the information about the fact that the wall is no longer there has to propagate inside the jet. So it sends the signal in, but since everything is so fastly moving up, that the rarefaction wave from the side is actually filling in. So wherever you see the color change, like here, see yellow goes to orange, and here it was all yellow, that's where the rarefaction wave has reached. So it's kind of a conal.
So it's a rarefaction wave. That means the acceleration is outwards, not upwards. So the gamma factor exists because the jet spreads out, not because
you can think of different ways of looking at this. I think it's a combination of both things. It's not just the fact that the jet spreads out. If I were to make the wall conical from here, the same exact effect would be there. It's just maybe there will be less acceleration right at the wall, but the acceleration in the bulk, which is present, will be exactly the same. So it's a combination of two things. Sideways motion.
That's the acceleration point. I mean, the velocity points upwards. It will always point upwards because of the gamma factor. But the acceleration, where does it point? Is it sideways, perpendicular?
It's both. It's both.
Okay.
But the main component that I'm interested in here, and the main physical component, is up. So there is also sideways thing, but it's an artifact of the fact that there is vacuum around. If there was any, because you imagine that this jet is embedded into some slower wind, some sheath, and that sheath will provide some small pressure. It won't be able to collimate it. It will probably maintain its opening angle at the same value. So the jet gets out of the star and just continues at the same opening angle. If I were to put the wall at the same opening angle, so the wall would be continuously collimating the jet to a constant opening angle, you will actually not see this rapid, abrupt increase towards the edge, because essentially what happens, the edge is receding and the fluff on the side is accelerating, but it has very little energy. So if I forget about that, the acceleration of the bulk, let's say here, is driven by radial acceleration. There is sideways acceleration, doesn't matter. But let's talk about this later. Your question. Good, okay, wonderful. And I'm happy to talk to you about this later. I'm not a scary guy, so come and talk to me. So, okay, well, let me first give you the idea of what I'm going to show you in the next slide. So I pick now a field line, which is essentially this field line, which is a characteristic field line that describes the acceleration in the jet. It's sufficiently far from the edge so that it's not contaminated by the edge effects. And in fact, this field line carries 50% of the energy, meaning 50% of the energy is confined within that field line, and 50% is outside of that field line. So it's a representative field line. So let me now extract the Lorentz vector profile and magnetization profile along this field line and plot them as a function of radius from the bottom to the top. And well, first of all, what you see is that this is the surface of the black hole or whatever compact object that's driving the jet. This is the logarithm of radius in the units of radius divided by the radius of the star. So log of this logarithm equal to 0 is the surface of the star. Log equal to 10 to the minus 4 is the surface of the compact object. And 10 to the 6 and a half is the outer edge of the box. So overall, we have 10 orders of magnitude or more, actually. That's the simulation's extent over. The vertical axis is the Lorentz vector. And so there are three curves here. Let's ignore this one for a second. Let's concentrate on the dotted red curve that hides under the green curve. This is a continuously collimated jet, the one that was on the left. What we see is that we start at Lorentz factor of 1 at the surface of the star, and then we accelerate as a power law all the way out to maximum Lorentz factor that the field line can support. This is mu. That's the energy content of the field line. This is the initial magnetization of the field line. So you see, eventually, you convert all of magnetic energy into kinetic energy. That's when gamma Lorentz factor is equal to mu, the maximum Lorentz factor possible for the field line. Okay, good. So what have we got? We have got a very fast jet, but very, very tiny jet. It will be collimated into nothing. So it doesn't describe the observations at all. Let's now look at a different jet, which is the deconfined jet that was on the right. This is the green one. The Lorentz factor increases exactly the same way inside the star, right at the surface of the star where the wall starts to decollimate. We have a jump in the Lorentz factor by about a factor of 5, as I showed you. Yes. The increase in the opening angle by about a factor of 2. And so then the Lorentz factor doesn't increase anymore. And we coast at gamma times theta equal to 20. That's what you saw on the previous plot. Now, how can we understand this acceleration business? Well, we can actually, there is an analytic description of this continuously confined jet that I developed a few years ago. Then there is also another solution of a jet where, let me go back to the previous plot, where we have an analytic solution for this jet, and we also have a solution for another jet where we would take this angle and confine the jet with a straight wall that would go all the way straight wall to the black hole. That solution of a straight jet also exists. And miraculously, what we find is that this solution shown with the blue line of that straight jet, coronal jet, is what we arrive at once we remove the wall. So the solution jumps from a continuously confined jet to the coronal jet. And we have both of them. So the only thing we don't understand fully is this violent relaxation from one solution to the other solution, this rarefaction wave going from the side to the center. But we know exactly what we will arrive at large distances asymptotically. And in fact, actually generalize it and say that the product of Lorentz factor and opening angle is equal to 20, which is a numerical prefactor, which is logarithmically dependent on variety of things, times the square root of the magnetization. This is the magnetization that I defined, the enthalpy of magnetic field divided by the rest mass energy density. So if the jets are weakly magnetized, let's say sigma is of order 1 far away, this is when magnetic fields carry the same amount of energy as matter, that's when we have a competition, then this product is large, 20. Now, also, there is a curve that I showed here in the gray, just for reference. This is the local magnetization of the jet. This is the sigma. It starts out very high at the bottom. It starts out at 1,000. Then it drops. As we convert magnetic energy into kinetic energy, the magnetic content drops. Kinetic content increases. So this ratio decreases, and that reflects acceleration. A sharp upturn in Lorentz factor, of course, is accompanied by a downturn in the energy content of the field line. And then this local energy content levels off as the acceleration levels off, and it levels off just around unity, 1. It's just what we wanted, a not very high magnetization. And since sigma is 1, gamma theta equal to 20 is what describes the solution. Okay?
Could you, when you get to the asymptotic value, could you imagine the stability is to turn this around?
So are you asking, if I understand you correctly, that once the jet has gotten to the asymptotic coasting phase,
yeah,
that it will like go all unstable and fall apart?
Well, I have turbulence, do I have enough dissipation in the system that process will never kick in? Turn this thing around.
What do you mean, turn this thing around?
Turn the sigma. So here, you went from a very high magnetization,
yeah,
to something that was equal.
So you want to magnetize it back?
Yeah, just for...
What you could do, I'm not sure how you could get back magnetic fields, very strong magnetic fields, by a turbulent process, if that's what
or
you have in mind.
MRI can.
Amplified, but MRI never amplifies things above one. You know, it always leads to a competition or subcompetition of magnetic fields. So here I would imagine that if you had pancakes of opposite polarities of sigma of one, they could reconnect and produce the radiation. That's what I think can happen. And one thing to keep in mind is, of course, here I didn't include any ambient medium. That's why I arrive at this at a constant velocity. If there was ambient medium that the jet had to accelerate or push apart, then this Lorentz vector would start to go down. This is an idealized model just to see what happens. In real life, this jet will slam into ambient medium, and then you have to model have a different model. Okay. Good. So what do we have? Applications to real things. So wake up those who fall asleep. So this is what we get. Lorentz vector times open angle is 20 times magnetization to the 1/2. If we are weakly magnetized, the sigma of order unity or less, then we get Lorentz vector times open angle of 20 or less, which is in agreement with observations. Here are the observations of gamma ray bursts, about 20 of them. These are the values that are inferred from the observation of the afterglow for this gamma ray burst, and the range between 8 and 90. Okay, so we understand those that are between 10 and 30, then as we expected, the jets are weakly magnetized, the magnetization is 1 or less. But how do we understand a gamma ray burst which has 100 for this product? Well, it means that we would plug in 100 here, divide by 20, it's 5, take the square of that, we get sigma of 25. It means that magnetic fields carry 25 times more energy than the kinetic energy of the outflow. So the jets, some of the jets, it seems, are very highly magnetized, if, of course, the magnetic model works. Actually, just recently, we wrote a paper that shows that the standard model of emission, this internal shock model that I was outlining before, has trouble even when magnetization is of order 1 or less. It has to be much less. So what we have to do is we have to invoke new physics for producing the prompt emission. Maybe internal shocks don't work. Maybe we want, not maybe, they don't work. We need to maybe resort to reconnection in the jet or some other process that would tap that magnetic energy and convert it into radiation. Great. Let me go to the next part of the talk. This is about jet power. Where do jets get their power from? And how do we measure power of the jets in observations? Well, a proxy for jet power is radioluminosity. As a jet slams into ambient medium, it shocks the ambient medium. It accelerates the electrons, which shine in the radio band, in other bands as well, but radio band in particular. And on the x-axis, I plot the volumetric luminosity, essentially the optical luminosity of an object. And this is all done for active galactic nuclei. Those pretty pictures, remember on the first slide, right? With the jets emanating from the center, that's the object that we're doing this for. So we measure the radio emission from these jets, plot it, log of it on the vertical axis. We measure the optical emission from the center, which is the accreting black hole, and optical emission from the center is the power of the accretion disk. And we plot it here. So we measure the efficiency, essentially. The ratio of this to this would show what is the fraction of accreted energy that came out in a jet. And that's what you do here. You would plot the ratio of this to this, which we call R, which is called radio loudness parameter. Plot the log of this in the vertical axis. On the x-axis, we show the strength of the accretion, the Eddington fraction, the Eddington ratio of the accretion flow. One means that the flow is so powerful that the amount of radiation that comes out from the center is large enough to spew out the mass just to due to the radiative pressure. So this is the, we think that zero is the limit, or some systems may maybe push it by a factor of a few. So this is why there are no systems to the right of zero, almost, or one at least, no more. These systems at the very, very low end are very low luminosity systems, and this is what we concentrate upon. The systems we think are in a very well-defined state, the same state of accretion. We think it's an accretion, radiatively inefficient, relatively thick disk. Here we think that there are state transitions that the accretion systems undergo, and that can change the luminosity of the jet. So let's concentrate on below 1%. This is what we think the cutoff is. And what we see here, we see two very well separated populations, the radio loud and radio quiet population. The radio loud and the radio quiet populations are different by maybe a factor of 10 to the 3. In their radio loudness. So these guys, for the same exact properties, the optical properties, which is what this is, they have dramatically different powers of jets. How can we understand this dichotomy. Well, one proposal was, well, these guys are most elliptical galaxies. And elliptical galaxies, we think maybe they came from mergers of two smaller galaxies, and the two black holes in the centers came together, merged, and they produced a rapidly rotating black hole, as Lewis simulates. And maybe this black hole has a spin that is very close to the maximum realizable spin of one, and so it produces a more powerful jet than these guys, which are mostly occurring in spiral galaxies, where the spins are lower, maybe 0.3 or so. And so maybe due to this difference in the spin, the jets are more powerful in the red guys than in the green guys. Well, let us test if this is a reasonable scenario. And you had a question.
Yes, you mentioned the luminosity there.
Yeah.
That accounts for line of sight and angles and line up and so on.
No.
So you try to...
Nothing.
So if you don't take that into account, then the system could appear.
Well,
just because you don't get the image.
It doesn't work out if you were to try to do the statistics, but also the fact that you don't account for those things is, you would imagine, oh, if the jet is pointing towards me, I will see it much brighter. That's maybe what you have in mind. Yeah, but the thing is, remember in the first picture, there were two jets, one of which you couldn't see, but the radio lobes were still there, and they were the same. And that's so you may see a scatter of a factor of two, maybe, because you always see the radio lobes. But this factor of two is nothing compared to a factor of 1,000. We're operating in astrophysics of factors of 1,000. Of course, it's not as far as string theory goes. There is a 10 to the 220. Well, there is only 10 to the 3 here. So, I mean, we can be called precise suns, but still, you know, factor of two is nothing for us. Factor of two, you know, no. So that was a joke, by the way, no insults. what determines theoretically the power of a black hole that's immersed into a magnetic field? That was shown by Blanford-Znaik in 1997 to be proportional to some constant factor, essentially times the square of the amount of magnetic flux that threads the black hole, times the square of the black hole spin, and divided by some and multiplied by some factors which don't depend on the spin. This obviously doesn't. Rg is the radius of the black hole, just proportional to mass, gm over c squared, and c is the speed of light. K is this numerical prefactor, which weakly depends on the geometry of the jet. If the jet is radial, it's 0.054. If the jet is collimating, it's 0.044, less than a factor of two. So you just assume it's a constant. So let's take this at face value, and see if we vary A between 0.3, as I was shown in the previous slide, and 1. Well, 0.3 and 1 squared, the ratio is 10, much less than 10 to the 3. So we definitely are in for some trouble. So the hope is, well, what's the next step to try and improve the theory? Well, this was derived as an asymptotic expansion around 0, slowly spinning black holes. What if we take the limit of A to 1, maximally spinning black holes? Maybe this thing will become very steep, and then we will solve all the problems. Well, let's see if that's the case. This is what I've done. I've run a number of simulations for different spins, spin of 0.1, 0.9, 0.9999, not quite 999. It's going 1.9 beyond that. Well, that was an American joke. We tried different degrees of collimation. The parabolical one, less than parabolical one, and the monopolar one. The bottom line is, for the same spin, there is almost no dependence on the shape as we anticipated. And now let me see how the power depends on the spin. So this is what I show here. I show the logarithm of power in the vertical axis, logarithm of this quantity, which I show here. It's the AC divided by 2RH. This is omega H. This is the angular frequency of black hole horizon on the horizontal axis. It turns out that the power of the black hole, which is shown in the numerical points, these colorful points, it follows the pink line. Which is the same formula as I was writing on the previous slide, but there is proportionality not to the spin squared, but to omega h squared, to the angular frequency of the black hole horizon. And this yellow stripe shows the classical prediction, the low spin formula that I showed in the previous plot, which is proportional to a squared. The rest is independent of the spin. So you see that the classical formula underpredicts the true power dependence on the spin by about a factor of 4. Because of this extra dependence. This RH is the radius of the black hole horizon, which goes between two gravitational radii for a non-spinning black hole to one. So there is a factor of two that we gain here as we go to high spin, and that two squared gives us a factor of four. But a factor of four is still not enough. We remember we had a ratio of 10. Now we multiply it by 4, we get 40. It's still a little bit too short, a factor of 30 short, but we're getting there of 1,000. So what else is left to be done? I will advertise my work a little bit here. Is that as you see, the numerical points miss the pink line a little bit. This is second order expansion. You can go to the sixth order expansion, and then that will be captured perfectly. So let's go to the next slide, which actually will try and push this model a bit further. So the model that we just looked at was a perfectly very thin disk around the black hole. The lines stick out of the black hole to show the energy flow lines out of the black hole. Energy flows out of the black hole. And so what we did, we collected all this energy, and that's what we were plotting on the previous slide. Now, in real systems, as I mentioned, low luminosity systems, the disk is puffy and thick. So what it will do, if we replace this thin disk with a thick disk with the aspect ratio H over R of about unity, some of the field lines will be muted. All of the energy that the black hole spews in that direction will be eaten up by the disk, and we will only see the radiation above and below the disk. So how do we count for that? Well, let us count only the radiation that is emitted by the black hole into a cone of some angle around the axis. And we will call that jet emission. So we will include the disk occultation in our model in the most simple way. And what happens is that the thicker the disk, the more steep power dependence on spin becomes. Essentially what happens is if you spin the black hole up, that bunches the field lines up towards the axis because of the toroidal field becoming stronger and stronger. Hoop stress pulls the field lines around the pole. So there is more field lines that are open as the spin is cranked up. And there is more power that comes out as opposed to if you didn't include that effect. And so here I show a few different curves for different disk thicknesses. This is a razor thin disk, the standard theory. This is log power as before. This is logarithm of the omega h, the black hole angular frequency. So we have power proportional to omega h squared, the standard dependence for razor thin disk. But as you take the disk to be thicker, h over 0.5, h over to be 1, at first the dependence is indeed the same. But then at higher spins, maybe spins of 0.5, 0.7, 0.9, 0.99, it becomes much steeper. It becomes omega to the 4, for instance, in the case of the thick disk. So if we take the ratio between here and here of powers, we actually get 1,000 pretty easily. So one way to solve the dichotomy problem is to assume that the disk is thick, and then you can solve it. You can do it. So this is what I recap here. We can associate the radial light population with rapidly spinning black holes with a spin of about 1, radio quad black holes with the spin maybe 0.15, and then we are able to get 1,000 quite easily. Well, of course, this is the cartoonish model. It just shows that in principle, if indeed there were two populations with vastly different spins, you could explain the factor of 1,000 difference in black hole outputs. But whether in real life this happens, it's an open question. We will have to do many more studies, much more research. But in any case, this 0.15 spin for radio quiet black hole is much more comfortable than the standard value that you would have to assume according to the standard theory of 0.03. 0.03 is really unrealistically small. Now, let me go to the last part of the talk. In the previous part, what I studied was mostly the dependence of power on the angular frequency of the black hole. The faster we spin, the more power we get. Now, I am going to concentrate on the dependence of power on the magnetic flux in the black hole. In the previous part, I assumed that it was constant because I didn't know what it depends upon. But now I will touch up on the subject, and I will try and see what the dependence is. To recap, the black hole power for a fixed amount of magnetic flux varies by about maybe 30. If we vary between 0.3 to 1, if we assume this formula, razor thin disk. If we assume a thick disk, like advection dominated accretion flow, as we think is appropriate for the cases that we consider, we can get a much more steep dependence with a ratio of 10 to the 3. So this is the same formula. I bet by now you remember it by heart. You will wake up at night and like, oh, powers omega h to the 2, and there is also phi squared there. So what is this phi squared? Well, phi squared is like b squared. Flux is like b times area. So flux squared is proportional to the accretion rate, just dimensionally. This is b squared, and accretion rate is rho times c squared. C is velocity, it's like ram pressure. Density times velocity squared, and velocities are all of the order of the speed of light near the black hole. So this is, just by dimensional argument, I can write down this equation. Great. But clearly, the power will sensitively depend on the prefactor here. If it's zero, then the power will be zero. If it's a million, then it will be, you know, pretty big. So let us divide this by that, and this is what I've done here in a proper dimensional fashion. So I get a dimensionless value at the end. This is my prefactor, small phi. And what I'm going to determine, what I'm going to do is determine this factor from numerical simulations. I will actually put an accretion disk around the black hole. I will press enter. I will wait for 2 weeks. And then I will get my one single value, as encouraging as it sounds. Well, so if I divide, so now let me define the theorist analog of radio loudness, the ratio of jet power to the accretion rate. We put this divided by that. We call it eta, Blanford's Naik. And this is this prefactor. Then this phi divided by m, phi squared divided by m, it's this small phi squared. And then I form this rotational parameter, which is essentially the angular, the linear velocity of black hole horizon. If you just naively say omega times the black hole gravitational radius squared. So what we expect is that the power will become larger if the dimensionless magnetic flux is larger and if the spin is larger. Now, what can we do about it? Well, people have done a lot of work on this, of course. I'm not the first one who is putting stuff around the black hole and asking the black hole to eat it. Gami and McKinney, McKinney Beckwith, Holling Krolik, McKinney and Blanford all looked at this problem. And what they found, this is a recap, executive summary, that depending on what you put in the accretion disk, is what you get. Essentially, you put in something, you get something out. You put in vertical field in the accretion flow, that vertical field falls into the black hole picks it up, produces a powerful jet. Put no vertical field, put a toroidal field in, the disk will be as happy, but there will be no jet because there is no vertical field. So if I put a lot of vertical flux, I get a powerful jet. I put no vertical flux, no jet. Can I predict anything? Well, that's the question I asked myself. And also another question is, well, the simulations found that the efficiency of jet production is 20% at most. Well, let's look at this in the terms that we all understand very well. So let's imagine somebody invites you to invest into a project, $100, Canadian dollars. You put in $100 into a black hole. That's what essentially it is, because you don't know the details. You dump $100 in a black hole, and $20 come out. Is that a good investment? Mm-mm. I wouldn't advise that. So can we be better? Can we do better? Can we make black hole an attractive project to invest in? After all, you know, we all advertise our science. So all these guys tried. They've got 20%. But what does it take to get a larger value? Especially because observationally, it seems like there are indications that some black holes actually produce enormously powerful jets with this investment efficiency exceeding 100. You can talk to Brian McNamara. Of course, the error bars and the measurements are quite large. They are between 10% and 1,000%. But at least the fact that the error bars, they stick out above 100, it makes one wonder. I mean, am I just dreaming, or is this really, you know, conceivable? So that's what I try to address. And how can I try and address it? Well, jet power increases with magnetic flux as a square. It's a steep dependence. If I were able to put more flux in, the power, twice as much flux, four times as much power. 20% times 4, it's already almost 100%. So if I were able to just increase the amount of flux by a factor of maybe 3, I would be fine. That's not much. So what shall I do? I will start the simulations just as everybody else was starting before me. I will stick in a disk. I will around the black hole. I would put vertical flux into the disk. But what I will do is I will make a disk take a disk that is long, it extends by three orders of magnitude instead of just one, as usually people would do. They would put a small torus around the black hole initially. And also, since the disk is big, I will stick in the field over all the disk, over all these three orders of magnitude. The field will be just as weak as people who did it before me. But now I have an surface area, I mean the disk surface area, pi r squared, which is 100 times larger than what people did before me. So we'll have 100 times larger flux that, in principle, can get into the black hole. And maybe not 100 because the field goes down, but maybe a factor of 10 larger than before me. And that's enough because I only need a factor of 3. What will they do? That will, if this flux goes all the way down to the black hole, eventually it will become so strong, the field will become so strong that the accretion flow will be stopped by this field. And what we will get is magnetically arrested accretion disk, which is called conveniently MAD. We will get MAD accretion flow. Let's watch it. Let me see if I can pause it. Oh, wow, nice. So here I show you 5 panels. I understand that's a lot, and that's already going to the end of the day. So I will walk you through each panel individually. Top left panel, colors show the logarithm of res mass density. Blue is 10 to the minus 6, very low. Red is 10 to the half, 30 is very high. So this is vacuum, essentially. This is the inner tip of my accretion flow. This is 50 gravitational radii. The disk extends all the way out to 10 to the 4. Gravitational radius. So I'll only show you a small window that zooms in on the center. In the center, there's a black hole which is spinning around the vertical axis. These lines show field lines in the image plane. There is no toroidal field initially to start with. It's all vertical. Okay. Now here, I show you a slice like this, horizontal slice, and I show you the meat. I show you the slice through the mid plane of the disk. You see, of course, high density in the middle of the disk. In the donut hole, initially, I don't put anything. You see blue. There is vacuum, essentially. And the black hole and the disk are co-rotating in the same direction counterclockwise. So if you see something... Oh, sorry. These arrows, if I actually were able to rewind back, these arrows would be initially straight. This would be magnetic field lines in this cut, and they would be initially straight because I made this plane to go just under the mid plane. See, the field is pointing radially inwards, and this is what I show you here. So don't really trust the direction of field lines because the field essentially vanishes in this plane, in the mid plane. The thickness of the field means something. Thin field lines means that gas pressure is the strong one. Gas pressure overwhelms magnetic pressure. Thick lines show that the magnetic fields are very strong. These last three panels show the accretion rate as a function of time, the magnetic flux as a function of time on the black hole, this dimensionless magnetic flux, and the dimensionless jet power, or investment efficiency in the black hole, or jet efficiency. And this is time in the units of light crossing time of the black hole horizon. I run the simulation for 30,000 time units, which is pretty long. This took 2 to 3 weeks on a supercomputer in 1,000 cores. So it was quite a big undertaking. The black hole is spinning at the spin 0.99. Okay. Good. So let's go and see what we see. So what first happens, you see that the fluff outside that I put in order to avoid vacuum that the code can't handle falls into the black hole. Ignore that. It doesn't really matter. The disk becomes turbulent because of the fields being sheared out and the magnetic rotational instability is acting. I can talk about this later offline if you're interested. The disk is driven in by that instability into the black hole. With mass, fields fall in into the black hole that thread the black hole. You see this here. The dimensionless black hole flux increases as a function of time. The red points show the current values. The efficiency of the jet also increases because it goes as a square of that. But as we wait longer, more and more flux ends up in the middle. It starts to squeeze the disk from above and below. And finally, the disk is squeezed out. The field lines reconnect and pinch off. A flux bundle flies into the disk. And since the flux is lighter than the surrounding accretion flow, it starts to buoyantly rise and being sheared by the flow. And that's what happens. Accretion flow wants to bring more mass and flux. It can't until the excess of the flux from the black hole escapes as a flux bundle into the disk, and then there is more room, and then more flux can fall in, and hence these are fluctuations. Flux bundles have been brought and escape from the black hole. So if we wait for long enough, then we can measure well-defined average flux on the black hole, average black hole efficiency, and the long-term average of efficiency is shown with a dashed line. It's clearly above 100%. You can see that actually most of the time the efficiency is larger than 100%, and on average it's 140%. It's a great investment. You put in $100, 140 flies out. This is great. Okay, of course the black hole will be spun down very fast. And I will talk about this in the next slide. But so far, let's watch the movie and let's try and see what's going on here. I will just show you a few examples. I'm almost done. I only need 3 more minutes. So, well, let me let it go. So when this flux bundle, this underdensity, goes here, you see that this is the same as this. This is just two different projections, right? So you see that this flux bundle originally was sitting in the black hole, then escaped, it expanded, so it became better, became bigger because it overpressured as compared to the ambient flow. It appears as a vertical flux bundle, and here it appears as an underdensity. So that's what happens. This underdensity will go somewhere as far as it can, and then it will be, once it becomes in pressure equilibrium with the surroundings, it will spread out slowly, get sheared out, and it will be mixed back in the flow and will fall back. That's what happens. There is this cycle. Recycling, it's a very green system. It recycles the flux that it has.
So then, just to make, to get it clear, so the difference between this work and the previous work is just that you were able to put a much extended disk?
Much more extended disk with
there's
a much
no
more extended flux distribution.
Right, there's no extra ingredient beyond that.
No.
Okay.
And this work has been published. You can pull it out of the archive. There is a link to the movie. You all can watch this movie. You can put it on your desktop as a screensaver, and everybody will be asking, what is that? And you will tell them, oh, well, there was a guy from Princeton. Okay. Anyway, whatever. So let's make the movie go. It goes on forever. I was just limited by the computing power, but if you go further and further and further, what you see is that more of the disk becomes turbulent. So you start to get a stationary self-consistent solution out to a larger distance, essentially a few Keplerian orbits at a given radius, and your system is roughly in equilibrium. Okay? Good. So I'm afraid I will have to stop the show, and go and show you a little bit more scientific slides. Isn't it pretty? Look how these things, when they get out, they get sheared out, and really, the poor disk is really totally dominated by the magnetic fields. Yeah, you see these field lines are very thick. This means that magnetic field density, energy density, exceeds the rest mass energy density of the matter. B squared over 8 pi is greater than rho times C squared. This is a really highly magnetized jet. The field lines, which are like medium thick, is where the magnetic pressure exceeds gas pressure. And then where they're very, very, very thin, then the magnetic field is subdominant to gas pressure. Magnetic field pressure is less than gas pressure.
This is taking the question. The inner boundary conditions here?
The inner boundary conditions are inside the horizon. We use horizon penetrating coordinate system, Kirchhoff, and they are outflow. We just copy things in. Yeah, they're really causally disconnected from the rest of the flow. Okay, good. So this is a time average flow, which shows the energy flow of the system. In color, the field lines in blue, the stream lines in these gray shades. So it's just another way of looking at it. You can see that in time average sense, the matter tries to diffuse through the vertical field. It diffuses through this field, and it also pushes it in. This is the jet. It's connected to the black hole. The energy flow, you can see that there is very little energy, 10 to the minus 3, fraction 10 to the 3, that's flowing in the midplane. As you go further and further and further, the color becomes more and more darker. So essentially, there is this is about 80% of the energy. So 80% of the energy is coming in the jet, 20% is coming outside of the jet. In the wind. Notice that all the energy flow lines are coming from the black hole. There is nothing that can be created in the poor disk itself. Because if it was, if the energy flow was coming from here above and below, how would the energy get there? Energy is conserved. So this is one interesting thing to keep in mind, that all of the energy, eventually, all of the energy flow lines will end up on the black hole. I'm happy to talk about this in more detail later. This is the Mani plot. This shows the dependence of dimensionless magnetic flux on the spin of the black hole. You can see that the flux changes between maybe 40 and 60. So there is almost no change of the flux with the black hole spin, which is very interesting. I didn't expect that to be. And so if you plug that flux into our formula that we have, we'll get this black line, which lands on the numerical points really well. You can see that rapidly spinning black holes of 0.99 give you efficiency of 100%. This is efficiency as a function of spin. 0.9, maybe 100, 120. 0.5, spin of 0.5 is about 30. So even for a mildly spinning black hole, you'll get 30% of return on your investment. Interestingly, if you go to retrograde black holes of minus 0.9 as opposed to spin of 0.9, the efficiency is about half of the prograde black hole, which is interesting. As you would expect, maybe there is a difference. There is almost no difference, a factor of 2 at most. The fit is only here. I just used a broken two linear fits, two linear dependencies of phi as a function of omega h. This is what it does here. And then the rest I just sorry.
Do you have
we are working on this. We're working on this. We don't fully understand this, but there are some interesting leads, and I'm happy to talk about this later. So this is essentially the final slide. As I mentioned, the power was so strong that the black hole will be spun down really rapidly. This shows the spin-up parameter as a function of the spin. Everything that's above zero will be spinning the black hole up, below zero, slowing the black hole down. Where it's zero, and this is the curve for MAD, it will be not spun up nor spun down. In comparison, here's a thin disk spin-up curve or essentially any other simulation that was done before. The intersection is somewhere above 0.9, which means that the equilibrium spin for a standard accretion flow, and everybody would tell you it's greater than 0.9 or 0.9 or something like this. Whereas for MADs, since they take out so much energy from the black hole, the poor black hole is spun down to zero, it's completely broke. It doesn't have any energy in the end. So you just give black hole enough magnetic fields, and all the energy sucked up from black hole, and the equilibrium spin is 0.07, essentially zero. Okay, so here is the recap. We have just shown you, I have just shown you, the new simulations where we give black hole all you can eat experience. And what the black hole does, it spews all it can in terms of energy. The black hole is spun down to zero, spin doesn't rotate anymore, and that happens only after it eats 10% of its mass. It's really, really fast. Retrograde disks produce jets that are about 50% less energetic than the prograde disks for the same absolute magnitude of the spin, and that's already mentioned. You end up with essentially a Schwarzschild black hole. That's it. Thank you very much. Okay, I'll put this down in case to protect you guys.
There's no connection between Madoff and.
Sorry?
You kept using the investment strategy analogy, so there's no connection between Madoff and you.
With what? Okay. Madoff? Oh, Madoff. No. Madoff,
Madoff,
yeah. Right, yeah. No prison, no. I'll get to you in a second. You had a question.
The black hole spin, what happened with it? Did you model that?
No, the change of the spin will happen over much longer time scales than 30,000 light cross in times of black hole that we went to. But we can compute the torque on the black hole. And so if I know the torque of the black hole at every spin, you know, I would simulate discrete points of the spin, then I can actually reconstruct what the trajectory, what the spin
how
down of the black
take?
Hole would be. Huh?
How long would it take? A million?
It will be, so for let's say 10 to the 8 solar mass black hole, one light crossing time is, let's see, so it's one, essentially it's 10 microseconds for 10 solar mass black holes, so it would be 10 to the 8 more, so it would be so 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the 3 seconds, 10 to the 3 seconds times, so I need to divide 10 to the 7 million years by 10 to the 3 seconds. That's how many light crossing times I have to wait in order for the black hole to be spun down. And there are 10 to the 5 times 10 to the 7.
That is good.
It will be.
No, No, it's smaller than.
Actually, yeah. It actually, maybe, yeah. Yeah. Well, it will be larger. Yeah.
So you had a spin graph on the previous slide. I didn't quite understand that. Is it spun up, spin down? What does that mean?
Oh. So what I show in the. One second. What was the question? Are you sure? This thing is, well, forget this for a second. This shows the change of angular momentum in the black hole as a function of time divided by per unit mass accreted. There is also small.
Oh, it's just the rate of the change, okay.
Rate of change. So when this rate with the small correction due to the definition of the spin, because there is a mass on the bottom and it changes. So anyway, when
it's spun down in the interesting cases.
So
it's
in the.
It's
spun up when the black hole is retrograde in the opposite direction as the disk, and it's spun down if it's prograde, essentially.
So essentially, the disk always spins down the black hole. They wouldn't spin it up.
Well, it will spin it up if they're oppositely rotating. But it's not interesting, you see.
It will spin it up.
The black hole will be spun up from 0 to 0.07. It will be spun down from 0.999 to 0.07.
It will be spun up in the sense that the absolute, that the magnitude of the spin goes down.
It will be spun down, sorry. Yeah, and it would magnitude of the spin, only between zero and this value it will be spun up. At least in this region.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then. Yeah.
I have a question regarding the geometry that you are using for release. So I have two questions. One is, did you find or did you study which is the threshold in the Have and Radix ratio for getting this powerful outcome? And second, how realistic is the geometry you are using is?
How does geometry of the disk influence the outcome?
Yeah,
how does the geometry of the field influence the outcome?
Yeah,
great question.
Also that, right? You mentioned that you put the field down to zero, close to the limit of the disk.
So let me try and address the questions. So this is a zoomed out view of the Christian flow. I showed you the small box of 50 times 50. Now it's 200 times 200. This is not the whole simulation box. The whole simulation box is 10 to the 5 times 10 to the 5. Okay. So this is the torus. You can see that this is very low density. Essentially, it's 1% of the pressure maximum density. This is where the torus pressure max is. And these are the field lines initially.
This is the whole piece?
The disk goes beyond that, if that's what you're asking about.
10 to the 5?
The disk goes 10 to the 4. Yeah, of course, there will be very little density. It's a self-consistent equilibrium hydrodynamic solution, exact. Now I impose a very weak magnetic field. Field pressure divided by gas pressure is no more than 1% anywhere. Plasma beta, if you like that more, is greater than 100. Plasma beta is the ratio of gas pressure over magnetic pressure. So I haven't tried other field geometries, but I can tell you for a fact that if I put less flux or flux is alternating signs, then you will not get that much power output. So what I get is the maximum power for a given field geometry. So for a given disk geometry. We know also we've run simulations for thicker disks, and thicker disks produce more powerful jets. From observations, we also know thin disks don't seem to produce much jet. So we think that there is some dependence of jet power on the disk thickness. These are for disk aspect ratios of 0.2, h over r, 0.2. Even though it looks thick, it's actually 0.2 because of the log density that I show. And the only new thing is that, see this field, the field lines are almost uniformly spaced, but they are spaced out far. So that's the new element. Essentially, what we'll end up with is that all of this flux will collect in the middle, if I run this movie, that's what will produce a powerful jet. And the more you weight, from the larger area the flux comes to the center, and the larger area is magnetically arrested, where the field is very strong and it can dominate the dynamics. Any other question? Oh, you have another question?
Yeah, but this is very good. My first part of the plan.
Yeah, you also have a question.
This is easy. The first part of your presentation, have the analytic solutions. Can you show that?
Yeah.
Because you have the confined and unconfined solutions, right? And it looks to me, I probably get it wrong.
So this was the very, very first part of it.
Yeah, the very, very first part.
the acceleration part.
Yeah. So when you compare the confined and unconfined machine, so yeah. So there it looks like the confined solution gets higher values of gamma, right?
Yes.
And the unconfined gets lower as well.
Yes.
But in your simulation, it's the other way around.
No. It's just because, I mean, true. Well, but I only showed
up to
here.
Okay.
Because otherwise, on a linear plot, it would be hard for me to show both the star and far away.
Okay,
so
okay,
I just showed.
Tell us one of my questions.
Yeah.
So in the second part of your talk, you were tying down the populations, radio loud and radio quiet populations to black hole spins.
Yes.
So what mechanism potentially explain why they would bundle up at 0.15, for example. I can understand possibility one, but 0.15.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
So this is
don't we have better constraints for
black hole spins.
Yeah.
We have maybe one very robust black hole spin measurement there's one galaxy with a phone number 0630, something like this, I forget exactly, where the spin is constrained to be greater than 0.98 or something like this. But that black hole is in this regime. And it actually is radio quiet, because we think it has a thin disk, which doesn't produce a powerful jet. All the other black holes, they have spin measurements, but they're contested by different groups. Even that spin measurement is also contested. But
so in some sense, yours is the first constraint.
Well, no. There are constraints on the black hole spin. Well, if you believe my model
right.
applies, then yes, then we think. But many other people had other models. And the true physics part, if I were to separate physics from astrophysics, the physics part is I have shown the angular dependence and spin dependence of power produced by a black hole threaded by given field geometry. And then I applied this to the astrophysical problem. How can you get spin of 0.15 for these guys? Well, one obvious way is you take my jets and let them spin it down, the black hole. It will get spin of 0.07, and that will be this. Okay. Another way that Modersky and Sikora suggested is that in spiral galaxies, they undergo discrete accretion events of small satellite galaxies with random orientations of spin. And if you feed the galaxy, a galaxy black hole, with random orientations of spin, like plus and minus, plus and minus, on average, it averages out to something that is of order 0.3 or less. Well, so I don't know, 0.15, 0.3, something like this. That's another way of slowing the black hole down. But yeah, maybe there is something else. But these are the ways that people are thinking about spinning black holes down. Other questions? Great, I exhausted you guys.